This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. T.C. McCarthy always wanted to be a writer, but life kept throwing up roadblocks. After his high school graduation, he approached the commencement speaker, who is none other than George Plimpton. T.C. was hoping for some advice on how to become a writer. Plimpton looks at him and says, "Don't." Undeterred, T.C. went on to the University of Virginia. He decided to work on his creative writing. He showed someone in the program his science fiction writing and was literally laughed out of the room. Guy says, "We don't do science fiction at UVA." T.C. quit school for a while, and then he returned, and when he got back to school, he abandoned literature for the sciences. He went on to a career at the U.S. Patent Office, later the CIA, but never gave up his writing. Finally, in 2011, he found success. His first science fiction novel, Germline, was published. The second book followed in March of this year, and the last novel in the trilogy was just released. It's called The Subterranean War Trilogy, the most recently Chimera. T.C. will be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill Sunday for the Bull Speck Summer Literary Festival. But first, he is here with us. T.C., welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about this trilogy, The Subterranean War Trilogy.
It takes place in the near future, maybe 100-200 years in the future. Basically, Earth has gotten to the point where we're running out of all resources. We've already run out of oil. Combat vehicles run on either fusion power or alcohol-burning engines. And man has basically gotten to the point where as soon as an underground, a new kind of mine or any kind of source of mineral resources are discovered, war almost immediately breaks out. And in the kind of background of all this is the fact that man has continued to advance in the fields of field of genetics, bringing into play genetically engineered troops. And so the two kind of conventional world of warfare and the genetic world of warfare kind of merge in all three of these books.
And each novel tells the war from a different perspective, different character. Let's talk about the first one, Germline. It is told from the perspective of a journalist. Tell us about that, the narrator and the book.
Sure. The narrator in that book in Germline is Oscar Wendell. I actually chose a journalist for the first book because I really wanted somebody who was an outsider, who didn't belong there, who brought in a perspective that was non-military, decidedly non-military, for a couple of reasons. A, it gave me a kind of reason to explain little military things to readers who might not be familiar with the military. So there was a practical aspect to that decision. But second, I thought it would be very, very dramatic in terms of the contrast that somebody who has no experience with these things would be able to kind of draw in the language chosen. Plus, a journalist would be able to describe things in a way that no one else could, in a very clinical way. And that's really what I wanted for this book. I'm a huge fan of Michael. I've never figured out how to pronounce his last name. Michael Herr, the person who wrote Dispatches, mm-hmm. Vietnam War correspondent. I really wanted to kind of take that style of reporting and bring it into the science fiction world to report the events that transpire in a future war.
But this is a flawed journalist, as we all are, and in his case, addiction is the problem.
Absolutely. I also wanted this to be a coming-of-age story in a number of different ways. The first was, you know, obviously when you find yourself in a situation like an all-out war like Oscar does, you have to grow up very quickly. But also I wanted him to kind of go through a transformation where his character arc would start out with somebody who was very self-centered. Addiction is a very self-centered thing. And then through somehow just gut instinct to just survive, he crawls his way out of that addiction and into something that more closely resembles being a normal human, I guess, in Oscar's case, so that by the end, he's not extremely different, but he certainly has changed a lot by the end of the book.
Your trilogy really explores the whole question of what it means to be human. We have someone struggling with addiction, as most of us one way or another do, and then we have these genetically engineered humans. They're carbon-based, and yet they're structured in such a way. Tell us about the genetic engineering that makes these soldiers.
Right. I think we're what's scary to me is that after I wrote these books, you know, it's funny, I should have done this the other way around, but I'll be honest. After I wrote these books, I started reading more about genetic engineering and recent advances. And we are getting to the point where we're able to clone. Obviously, we cloned sheep a long time ago, but we're getting to the point where little advances are being made here and there, where what I've outlined in these books is certainly possible, maybe not as far out as I originally had thought. And that's a scary thing in some respects. In other respects, it's very exciting. If you look at the field of transhumanism, for example, there's a number of people out there who think that in order for us to really make it to the next level, to colonize space, to do any number of things, we're going to have to control evolution ourselves. Mankind is going to have to kind of take the reins over from God, if you believe in God, but take the reins nevertheless, and decide, all right, well, what kind of body type are we going to need to really withstand high G forces in space, or being bombarded by radiation constantly, and those sorts of things? So, it really, once you start down that road, it's a slippery slope in terms of thinking of all the different possibilities. I just had to decide, all right, I'm not going to go that far down that road. In this case, I'm going to start very early, where man has finally, you know, come up with the ability to manufacture another human being and give these human beings the exact traits and characteristics that would make them optimal for combat situations.
And we can talk more about them if we talk about your second novel, the most recent, although your third is out now. This is a told through the perspective of a genetic. She's a soldier. She's a woman. So tell us about the particulars. What are the characteristics of these soldiers?
Yeah, they're bred in tanks. They are basically grown, and every step of their growth has to be timed perfectly, but they're grown in accelerated fashion until the point where they reach about 15 years old equivalent, meaning they're about the same age biologically, if not temporally, to a 15-year-old human being. They're girls. They're all girls. In Exogene, I believe you find out that originally they had experimented with male genetic soldiers, but that those that experiment didn't turn out so well. And I'll leave it at that. I don't want to spoil anything. and you find out more about that in book three as well. So once they're 15, they're decanted from the tanks, and they're begun. Let me back up. Before they're let out of the tanks, they're trained in terms of combat and strategy and tactics, the tactics and strategies that they need anyway, by coupling computers and organic matter. So basically, you know, think Matrix, where they've got cables running into their head, that sort of thing. Nothing original there. But then they're decanted, and part of their training is they're trained to believe that the only way for them to go to heaven and to find a seat next to God is to die in combat, or at the end of their service term, if they make it through 2 years of a service term, to be discharged, quote unquote, which is basically a bullet in the head. They have a very unique perspective on life.
And they don't live long anyway, even if they survive combat.
Correct. Yeah. Even if they manage to escape, there's kind of a built-in fail-safe mechanism called the spoiling, which pretty much, makes them rot from the inside out.
That'll do it. Will you read for us?
Sure. Absolutely. This is from book three, Chimera. And just to give you a little bit of a setup, the main character is Stan. He's with his partner, Ji-hoon, and they've been assigned the task of going to Thailand, where the Thai army is going to escort them to the border with Burma, where there's a kind of bush war going on over resources. So this little section here, they're with a Thai army convoy, and the convoy gets ambushed. He didn't even pause, and I had to give the guy credit. Ji-hoon slipped the camera into a pouch and geared up in under 10 seconds, calling over our radio in twangy Thai that crackled in my ears. But it was already too late. Our road ran along the top of a dike with steep dirt and gravel sides that dropped about 10 feet into the fields on either flank. Although the APCs could make it down such a slope, the trucks would have to stay put. I had just grabbed my carbine, which had been slung over a shoulder, when the first rocket streaked out of the tree line ahead of us, clanging into the lead APC after a loud whoosh. Time stopped. I don't remember deciding what to do or telling Ji-hoon to follow, but we leapt from our APC as it screeched to a stop and both of us rolled down the sides of the dike after an impact that snapped my jaws together. I tasted blood from having bit the inside of my cheek. Jehoon rolled to a stop beside me. We stood in a crouch and jogged toward the trees where the rocket had come from, but kept to the area where the fields met the dike, our feet sucking in and out of thick mud in a shallow ditch. We had made it about 10 meters when daisy-chained geysers of asphalt and clay leapt up to our left. At first it didn't register. Then I noticed that my speakers had cut off to shield my ears, and shadows appeared where none had been before, so there was just enough time to look left and see the line of explosions work their way down the road, hitting the APC on which we had just ridden. The vehicle leapt up. A fraction of a second later, the fusion reactor went, and small jets of plasma shot out from cracks in the hull. The vehicle broke in two, already burning before the separate pieces landed. A few seconds later, my hearing came back as bits of uniform, armor, and ceramic chunks from the vehicles either floated down around me or thudded into the brush, along with, miraculously, our packs. They hadn't even been singed. "Mines," I said over the radio. "They mined the road."
T.C. McCarthy reading from his most recent novel, Chimera, the third in a trilogy, the Subterrane War Trilogy, and he will be reading at Flyleaf Books this Sunday. First, he's on our program. By making these genetically engineered soldiers carbon-based, a lot like us, flesh and blood, I think you've done something here that's pretty wonderful in that they are always prone to some kind of emotion. They're always prone to escaping their master's, right?
Sure.
Best plans.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see that most dramatically, I think, in book two, where we follow the path of just one such genetically engineered soldier, Catherine. And the problem there is that although the masters, us humans, have done our best to program them to believe in God and to believe that the only way to get to God is through death and that that's the ultimate outcome in life, the reality of what they experience on the battlefield begins to kind of slowly insert the idea of, hey, wait a second, maybe this isn't the only way to look at this world or the only thing that we need to pay attention to and believe. And they get that really by looking at and observing real humans and how they interact in battle.
It's interesting in the way you structure the novels too, because you put in stark contrast those abstract principles for which we fight. And cynically, we come to understand pretty quickly that that's not really what's at stake here and that war is pretty darn gritty, as you heard in that excerpt that you read. And again, by keeping them carbon-based, there's this possibility that even when you try to program individuals, whether you do it culturally through media or any kind of propaganda or through their genetics, you can't ignore the lie of these abstract
right.
principles.
And, you just brought up something that people tend not to bring up or ask me about, and that is that, okay, when you've got a book, there's only so many things that you can fit in terms of themes and character types, et cetera. Otherwise, you wind up with a 1,000-page book, and that just doesn't work. In this case, what
worked
I wanted
for Tolstoy, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, yeah. I don't think Tolstoy would be published today.
Probably right.
It's not commercial. but, one of the things that I wanted to do was, in addition to having genetically engineered soldiers, is explore the aspect of, what would society have to look like? What would a society have to look like to get to the point that we see in these three books? And so, what I decided to do was, in the first book, it was almost the same approach that Seurat would take in making a painting. The first book, you get the soda straw view, very close in through the eyes of Oscar Wendell, and you don't really see much of what else is going on in the world. In book two, we pull back a little bit and we start to get a sense of, oh, okay, so there was a nuclear war that took out, a big portion of East Asia. That's interesting. I wonder what happened there. And then it's only in book three that we pull back all the way to get the kind of full geopolitical perspective in terms of the fact that the U.S. is actually a police state at this point, and that there are state-sponsored brothels in order to supply the requisite number of people to serve in the military, and it's a very bleak kind of picture that gets painted by the end of book three. So, in that respect, it's kind of like Tolstoy, isn't it?
A little bit. And unfortunately, things are moving so fast that futuristic becomes formeristic all too quickly.
Absolutely. In these days.
So here's the thing. You're utterly discouraged. You go up to Plimpton in high school. You say, what do I do? He says, don't. Tell me about this thing at UVA where you showed him.
I can't remember exactly what the circumstances were. But when I went to UVA, okay, Plimpton, I shrugged that one off.
Right.
And I decided, I really wanted to write. I've been doing it since I was 12. I was still convinced that's what I wanted to do. So I get to UVA, and, I was 18. So let's face it, I was also partying a lot. And that was taking up a lot of my time. But I was also writing still. And they had, for English majors, they had a creative writing track, as I recall. But it was by application only. So not everybody could get into this creative writing kind of concentration in the English major. And I applied and I gave them some of my writing samples. And I wish I could remember the name of the person who was in charge of the program. I remember he was a very famous literary author, John. I'm sure if you go to the UVA website and Google who the famous authors are,
you'll
figure it out. But he laughed at me. I mean, he literally laughed at me and he said, I'm sorry, we don't do science fiction here. Next.
And right then and there? I mean, you just
I stayed in school for the rest of the semester, and then I just went to my dean, Dean Blackburn, who unfortunately has passed away, and I owe him a lot. But I went to my dean, and I explained what was going on, and I said, listen, I don't think school is for me. I'm going to drop out for a bit and surf and work construction and just kind of hang out and see what I want to do with my life. And to his credit, he said, listen, that's fine. We will keep the door open for you. We're not going to list you as, dropped out or whatever the actual term is. We're going to just put you on a leave of absence for a little while and see how things go. Just keep in touch. So eventually I realized that without a college degree, I would be, moving a lot of concrete in wheelbarrows for the rest of my life. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but that was not how I envisioned my life going. So
you went back, concentrated in the sciences.
Correct. Yes.
And then you took a job at the patent office, and eventually you went to the CIA.
Yeah. When I finished my PhD, I realized it was a soul-searching moment. I looked down the path of becoming a professor, and I realized that I would be bouncing from associate professorship to associate professorship, making not all that much money, with only a very slim chance of becoming a full tenured professor eventually if I kept at it for 10 or 15 years. I didn't want that. I wanted to get out and actually make some money and live a little bit, because I had been making, I'd been living off of $10,000 a year or whatever the stipend was for 5 years, and I had had enough of starving. So, so I went up to D.C., got a job with the patent office, and decided I was going to go to law school. And the patent office has a deal where they will reimburse you for law school. So I thought, that's a great deal. I applied to law schools, got in, and I had forgotten at some point during all of that soul searching, I had applied for a job with the CIA. Just to, went on their website and sent in an application for any, random job. And all of a sudden, it's probably 2 months before I was supposed to show up to law school, I get a phone call to, come in for an interview. And I can't swear on this program, I guess. But my reaction was, oh, blank.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, because you're hoping it's for the job and not for some other reason that they want to talk to you. So you took a job at the CIA. So, okay, what's the coolest secret you learned at the CIA?
I can't tell you that.
What'd you do with the CIA? You can't.
Well, here's what I've been cleared to say. Yeah. And I told Alex this when I spoke to him a while back.
It's our producer, Alex Granados.
The funny thing is that if I could tell you, if I could sit here and explain to you what I did on a daily basis, you'd be asleep in 30 seconds.
No.
I mean, it's that boring. If you look at Jack Ryan, he's the guy that gets to go out and, travel to Russia and shoot people and do all these things. And in those movies, there's always some guy who's kind of an egghead, going bald, getting fat, sitting in a computer. I was that guy who, never does anything fun. Right, I was an analyst.
You can't tell us. Who killed Kennedy? Really? Just one last question.
All I know is it wasn't me.
All right. It wasn't you. So you are going to be at Flyleaf Books tonight. The trilogy is finished. I can ask you very quickly. You got about 10 seconds. Are you working on your next, is it a series?
What's coming up? Absolutely. I've already plotted out my next science fiction book. But in the meantime, I'm trying to sell a literary novel about a young kid in Athens, Georgia, who is a drug dealer and a drug manufacturer. He's kind of a chemical savant who falls in love with a 16-year-old prostitute. and has to kind of wind his way through the decrepit scene in Athens, Georgia.
When that literary book comes out, you will be able to tell John Casey, who's the guy you can't, whose name you can't remember.
That is the name.
That's John Casey, that Alex Renatos or one of our crack producers, you know, sent that in,
that
even as we spoke. So when you come out with that, you'll show him up. T.C. McCarthy, author of the Subterranean War Trilogy, the latest book in the trilogy, Chimera, out, and it is out now. T.C. is going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill this Sunday. If I said otherwise, I was mistaken. He will be at Flyleaf Books Sunday from 2 to 4 for the Bull Spec Summer Literary Festival. For more information, go to tcmccarthy.com. The Duke Street Dogs are up next. Stay tuned.